From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is my current affairs colleague, Rick Pantaleo, author of VOA's Science in a Minute and host of the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. On this edition of the program, Amy Webb, author, futurist, and founder of Future Today Institute and futurist Mark Palatucci, join us for our annual conversation about the future of technology and its implications for business, society, and politics. The Future Today Institute is a leading future forecasting firm now in its second decade. Founded by Amy Webb in 2006, the Future Today Institute focuses on how emerging technology and science will disrupt business, transform the workforce, and ignite geopolitical change. Speaking of disruption, the COVID-19 pandemic was a major disruptor in 2020. So we will ask Amy and Mark how the pandemic affected the workplace, especially the use of remote meeting platforms, and if some of these changes may forever alter the nature of work, whether in the public or private sector. We will also discuss the pandemic's disproportionate impact on and implications for the travel and leisure industry. Amy Webb is the author of several books, including her latest, The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. The book warns of the role nine of the world's biggest tech companies are playing in the development of artificial intelligence and how it could affect all of humankind. Today, Amy and Mark talk about artificial intelligence, technology trends that shaped 2020, and what we can expect in 2021 and beyond. Amy and Mark join us via Microsoft Teams, another indication that we are not yet out of the woods as we all continue to social distance due to the coronavirus pandemic. Amy and Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And as always, I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, in-house science, technology, and health guru, Rick Pantaleo.
Good to be here.
Amy, general question first. Can you give us an overview of this past year's Emerging Trends Report?
Sure. Every year we put together a compendium of all of the different longer-term trends that we are investigating and following. They tend to fall into some categories. In the past year, we've particularly paid interest to emerging science and tech that has to do with healthcare, communications. So those would be things like augmented reality and diminished reality in the healthcare space. This would be using personal data and trying to understand or make sense of your personal health needs. Of course, artificial intelligence, autonomous vehicles, there's been a lot. Some new things that we've really had on our radar have to do with collaborative robots. So these are robots capable of working with each other, something that we call the U of things. So this is like the Internet of Things, except the things are on your body, so things that you wear. And a host of other technologies that cross over into more sort of science. So this would be nanobots, programmable matter, synthetic biology, things like that.
Well, Amy, let me follow up with something a bit more pedestrian. COVID-19 was a major event and still is with us in 2021. But in 2020, COVID-19 transformed the way we work. For example, we're on this remote platform on Teams. There's Zoom. I wanted to get an idea from you how you think this pandemic has indeed transformed the workplace, how people work generally, and to what extent it may extend even beyond the pandemic once the vaccine takes effect and people are immunized. To what extent will our manners of work be part of the architecture of everyday life?
One of the most interesting stories I heard from 2020 has to do with one of the world's largest companies, and it's based in Japan. That company is Fujitsu. What's interesting about Fujitsu is it has, I think, 130 employees. It's one of the world's best companies, one of the world's most active companies in telecommunications and infrastructure and IT. It's also a Japanese company. And a lot of Japan went back to work pretty soon after the pandemic hit. And Fujitsu, created a new policy, which was that employees can work from home over the long term. Now, whether or not this is a permanent policy, we'll have to wait and see. But a Japanese company, which operates very traditionally, it's very against the culture to have people working not in an office. For a company like that, it is a really big change. That didn't just mean a cultural shift. It also required a lot of organizational changes and technological changes. And for me, this was one of the biggest signals coming out of this entire thing. We're really seeing companies of all shapes and sizes changing how they operate to allow for more flexibility and to allow workers to be in places that are the most convenient for them and to put a lot of more of their systems online. One of the, I think, tensions created by the virus is that a lot of companies really weren't positioned to go all virtual, and they weren't really making use of the cloud. So that's another huge shift that we saw.
Let me now turn to my colleague, Rick, for some questions.
I have a question about how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected your business and the forecasts that have been made and will be made. Has it affected, for example, the algorithms that your company uses to make its projections?
We've been quite busy. I think the pandemic has brought to the forefront kind of all the uncertainties and risks that are out there that are just simply unforeseen by a lot of the clients that we work with. And so while those risks are ever present, and even the risk of something like a pandemic has been present for quite some time now. And if you look back to previously to last year, there were a lot of people who did sort of, I wouldn't say predict, but certainly forecasted something like this pandemic coming upon them. People don't, and companies don't really necessarily recognize the true gravity and reality of such a situation until it hits us all so hard as coronavirus has.
And speaking of impacts, what has the impact of the contentious 2020 presidential and congressional elections had on your trends?
Policy uncertainty is always present. I think over the past 4 years, there's been an unprecedented amount of uncertainty, in part because we're sort of in this new situation where we've got a lot of vitriol on Capitol Hill, people coming from non-traditional positions entering the public space, and quite frankly, a change in direction from the previous administration. The United States does not have a Department of the Future. We used to have something called the Office of Technology Assessment, which was charged with doing some longer term thinking that was divorced from politics. We don't have that anymore. It got defunded in the 90s. And so, unfortunately, a lot of the conversations and thinking and policy around technology and science become politicized. And that was very true in the past 4 years. So looking ahead, anybody in any area of business or anybody working in any part of any government, whether it's your local village government or your national government, you have to really look at the Venn diagram of science, technology, and politics because they are inextricably tied. My assumption is that over the next couple of years, it's going to take us a little bit of time to find a new normal because the policies that we're very likely looking at from the United States going into the next few years are going to be very different from the ones that we recently had. And the easiest example of that is probably climate. Over the past 4 years, we've walked away from the Paris Climate Accord and really drastically changed our national viewpoints on various issues related to climate. That has a trickle-down effect to companies that have to make decisions about their supply chains. I know this stuff is kind of boring, but it has a direct impact on things like R&D and investment. Companies have to do long-term planning of their own. And when we have a lot of uncertainty at our highest levels of government, that makes their work very challenging. I think we're now headed into a different direction, arguably one that's better for the longer term, but the policy uncertainty will not go away. It's going to take us a few years to right the ship.
Well, from policy questions to artificial intelligence, and maybe Mark Palatucci wants to take this, I would like for you to give us a sense of the potential for good that AI presents in 2021 and beyond, and what are maybe some of the drawbacks?
Sure. Well, one of the things that I think has shifted somewhat last year was AI runs on data. Data is the fuel that really powers the engine of AI. And a lot of the data is coming from, you know, individual citizens and being collected en masse. And in the past, there has been an understandable reticence to necessarily give up data when we have the choice. We don't necessarily want to give out this information that can be quite personal at times. But interestingly, when the pandemic hit, it actually allowed for the rollback of a lot of potential protections for personal data. Because if you take something like contact tracing, where data about where you have been, who you've been near, and that's data that is usually transmitted via a personal device like a smartphone, that can be quite intimate personal data. However, if it's being collected and used with the intent of keeping a city or a country safe, then the government has a much easier time explaining to the public and justifying their actions in collecting that data. So as we've seen across a number of different kind of realms and fields, COVID has acted as an accelerant, so not necessarily introducing altogether new elements to our society, but speeding up certain elements. And one of those elements has been the facility with which companies and devices can collect our data and then what that data can be used for. And ultimately, that makes AI that much more powerful in all of its many manifestations.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guests are Amy Webb and Mark Palatucci of the Future Today Institute, a leading future forecasting firm. Amy is the Institute's founder and CEO, and Mark is a futurist with the company. And this is a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website at voanews.com/PCUSA and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. We hope you'll also get in touch with us through either Facebook or Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or by sending us an old-fashioned email to pcusa@voanews.com. And now back to our Press Conference USA with Amy Webb and Mark Palatucci of the Future Today Institute. And let me turn to my colleague, Rick Pantaleo, for another question.
Amy, Mark, I've been going through some of your recent newsletters and looking at some of the emerging trends. And the one thing that comes to mind first is something that you've indicated, diminished reality. We're looking at DR versus AR versus VR. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. So this, you know, may be second nature to many of your listeners, but it's important to understand the very sort of fundamental differences between AR and VR. So AR being augmented reality, you're introducing new virtual elements to your environment, whereas VR is fully immersive, right? So that you're being sort of virtually transported from your environment to one that is entirely different, that's either been virtually generated or is emulating some sort of environment that is remote or foreign to you. When we talk about AR, however, there's a little bit almost of a bias in that term, because when we say augmented, we think of additive elements. If I'm looking through a set of smart eyewear, for example, augmented reality might introduce a data overlay to the city or the people that I'm looking at, or even introduce sort of synthetically generated characters or elements to my field of view. When we talk about the sort of subfield within AR of diminished reality, we're actually talking about sort of muting or suppressing features and elements of our surroundings rather than adding to them. So one pretty obvious example that I'm sure a lot of your listeners can relate to would be noise-canceling headphones, right? That's kind of muting what might be sort of distracting or unwanted noise in our sort of field of hearing around us. But when we extend that concept into the field of vision as well, it becomes quite interesting. Out of a crowd of people, be able to focus in on one person in the crowd using diminished reality to sort of blur out the view of all of those other people. And while this might be useful in making an individual's day-to-day life a little bit more comfortable, right? You don't have to look at or listen to those things you don't want to. There's also applications in, for example, the medical field. Studies have been conducted with patients who are on the autism spectrum for whom certain visual cues or audio stimuli can be quite disruptive and distracting. And so diminished reality has been used to sort of subdue those potentially triggering elements for folks who are on the autism spectrum and has allowed them to sort of focus and interact in a way that's more comfortable. So a very fascinating subfield of augmented reality, which is DR.
Another one of the emerging trends involves consumer behavior. And I know this past year, especially with the pandemic, consumer behavior has definitely shifted. There's more online purchasing done over the past year than ever before, with the brick and mortar stores sort of taking a back seat. What are your thoughts about what's going to be happening as far as consumer behaving? And will new technologies such as AI help us better understand consumer actions?
You know, the consumer tensions that were present in the past few years have shifted in response to not being able to be out in the world as we normally would. I think that, combined with, in many parts of the world, slowdown in the local economy, has led to pretty sizable shifts in consumer behavior. But that being said, this is an area where we've seen technology step in and provide some interesting solutions to resolve some of those tensions. So areas that we've seen take off have to do with delivery. In the state of Pennsylvania, for example, some local ordinances just cleared the way to allow land-based drones to make deliveries, which probably would not have happened had it not have been for COVID. Likewise, we're seeing an acceleration of air-based deliveries, or at least more pilots to allow that technology to be used, which again, we probably would not have seen otherwise. There are pretty big changes happening in the biotech sector related to fast-tracking clinical trials related to the vaccine, and a lot of consumer transactions that have to do with touchless payments. Somewhat interestingly, in the same year that many cities rolled back their ordinances on whether or not you can use cash, this kind of became a thing in 2019 and 2020 around the world. A lot of communities, a lot of stores no longer accepted cash. Everybody decided that that was a hardship for many people, and so those got reversed, and then they got reversed again because touchless, contactless payments are safer in the age of COVID. And what that did was accelerate a move to digital terminals and things like that. So broadly speaking, the way that we receive goods, the way that we pay for goods, and the way that we shop for those things online versus in stores will probably stick with us well after the pandemic has subsided.
Amy or Mark, I have a two-part question. One, you talk about in your emerging trends that technology has been key to helping feed a growing world population and that big tech has taken a greater interest in farming. Can you explain?
So I can think of a couple examples where technology has sort of advanced progress on making the most of the global food supply. So one of them would be in vertical farming. So moving these kind of vast plots of land that, you know, are sort of located throughout the country and the world that are used to farm naturally, organically, and sort of transitioning that whole process into an indoor, more highly controlled environment. Now, this is useful in and successful in a couple of ways, but one of the most important is that if you're a farmer who's been used to sort of farming on the open land and is now going to be able to produce food indoors, you can now control that climate and all of the various stimuli and nutrients that your crops are receiving. So you're no longer kind of responding to the whims of the weather, the seasons, and other risks that can present for farmers in kind of the open natural world, right? So it allows for a lot more control. Amy and I have also worked with clients who have either partners in farming or that's part of their supply chain. And a big movement right now is towards the smart farm. So being able to track everything from livestock to vegetables, plant-based crops, track their progress, and even use AI to determine what might be most beneficial course of action to help them grow into the sort of product that that farmer might need.
Amy, you also talk about in your Tech Trends report that, quote, everyone alive today is being scored, unquote, and we're not talking just about China. I wanted you to explain that. What is scoring, and why should we potentially be worried about that?
You know, in order for our automated systems to work, they have to quantify us in some way. And there's nothing nefarious at play here. It's just the way that our systems were built to work. The challenge is that as our automated systems evolve, they require more and more of our data. And that means that we're being quantified in ever new ways. And most people aren't aware when that's happening. Most of the time, this is invisible. You don't know that it's happening until there's a problem. And we've seen over the past 12 months, lots of problems that have to do with police misidentifying somebody because of their skin color. There have been plenty of instances of algorithmic scoring misidentifying a person of color as a criminal when in actuality they were not. We've seen people receive different prices for things like toilet paper when shopping online, because a third party has correlated their data, assigned a score, and determined that they're likely to pay a higher price. In a lot of countries around the world, including in the United States, there are laws against charging different people different prices based on their ethnicity or their skin color or gender. Those laws don't apply in the same way in the digital realm. When we talk about algorithmic scoring, we tend to think of China, and it's useful to know that, you know, in some way, we're all being watched, we are all being surveilled, and we are all being scored all the time. In some ways, China is just more transparent about it. Now, I will also say that in the past few months, it's come to light that China is using aggressive scoring techniques, specifically targeting the Uyghur population for the purpose of detaining them or infringing on their basic human rights. So this is something that we as an organization are certainly paying attention to going into 2021, and we'll be paying attention throughout the year. But, you know, everyday people, this is really an important thing for you to be paying attention to as well.
And Carol, you mentioned earlier, what are the differences between AI being used for good and AI potentially being used for harm? And you mentioned that in many of its forms, AI is a system by which to make decisions. And so if I as an individual have given up my data or my data has been taken from me, and now this AI system, wherever it may be, is making a decision for me, it doesn't necessarily make it, that decision on my behalf. And I think that's the difference between, or one of these instances where we can see AI for good versus AI that might be a little bit more harmful or detrimental. If the AI is making a choice to charge me more for a product because they know my willingness to pay might be higher, well, that doesn't feel like a decision being made on my behalf, but it's being made for me. So I think transparency is quite important when we talk about AI and data governance. And also, as Amy mentioned, just a vigilance from the individual to know that anytime they're working with a system, if AI is involved, there may be decisions being made behind the scenes, and making sure that you're sort of as aware of those as possible.
Amy and Mark, I wonder if you could tell us about the 2021 speculative travel calendar that your company recently released. And in conjunction with that, to what extent do you think that the travel and leisure industry can recover from the deleterious impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, whether it's air travel, hotels, cruise ships, and of course, restaurants and so forth?
I'm happy to take the piece about what the industry can do to recover. Mark, why don't you describe the genesis of the calendar and what it is, and people really love it. So maybe you could go into that.
Absolutely. So at year end every year, we like to produce either a small asset or a product, something that really embodies our mentality in strategic foresight, but also something that we can have a little bit of fun with, something that we can share with our followers, our fans, our network clients as well. This past year, we decided to play off of the pandemic in a certain way. Now, the pandemic is a very serious topic, but it had some potential repercussions, especially around travel, that we wanted to kind of have a tongue-in-cheek take on. So what we created was a calendar kind of in the style of old-timey travel posters that you might see at a travel agency. But rather than the destinations being these idyllic scenes trying to lure people to travel there, they were more of these absurd or potentially dystopian scenes of how technology might affect some of these different locales. So one of my favorites is the calendar actually leads off with the destination of nowhere. And this is a playoff of what some of these travel companies have actually done, at least in the short term, when the pandemic really shut down travel, or at least leisure travel. They began offering flights essentially to nowhere. So these are round trip flights. It's just one flight round trip, right? So you take off and land in the same airport. And these provided a little bit of like a scenic tour potentially of the, you know, landmarks rather surrounding the airport and the area. But it was kind of this funny, small fix that some of these airlines tried to implement. And it certainly is not a long-term solution to the massive loss of business that they've had.
The travel calendar, it's what's called a visual scenario where we speculate, but use data and evidence to try to think about next order impacts and what might happen. But in reality, the travel industry is facing a reckoning. And again, I think that there are analogies to what's happening in travel to other industries. There are always problems plaguing industries and companies because they do not invest in long-term planning. So there were already endemic issues facing the airlines with regard to data governance, how people were traveling, what they were willing to pay for, climate change, you know, things like that. And certainly when it comes to rail travel, long distance rail, short distance high speed rail is popular in lots of places around the world. It has been attempted in fits and starts here in the United States. But again, these are long term infrastructure projects and there's not a lot of appetite to do that type of long term investment or planning. And it's important to remember that in this exact same year in New York City, where Mark and I live and work, the MTA shut down for maintenance after, I think, 100 years. And it's been a real challenge, a real headache. So these are all very good reminders that even after the pandemic, it's hard to think of this now, but you know, people are going to want to travel. Business will pick back up. People will continue to go places. But the business models as they existed before were a little broken. And this is a really good opportunity to go back to the whiteboard and think through how improvements can be made that serve the greater good over the longer term.
Amy, as we close, I would like to ask a quick question about the internet, but it has to do with social media. We've talked about this so many times on the program. But are you any more optimistic about, let's say, Facebook or any of the other platforms, Twitter, with respect to keeping off bad actors or fake accounts? Because we are seeing, you know, a proliferation of hate speech, of outright disinformation. We saw that during the campaign, our campaign, other election campaigns across the world. And I'm just concerned that this is going to be with us for some time. Do you see any actions on the part of these companies to in any way combat this very dangerous trend?
Let me say this. There's the action that the company is taking at a corporate level, and then there are the people who work within the companies. These are enormous publicly traded companies that have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders, and everybody now knows that salacious, incendiary content drives more traffic, which means more eyeballs, which means more money. Now, that being said, there are a number of federal actions and state level actions that all of these companies are facing right now. And I happen to know several teams and several people who work in places like Facebook who are working very, very hard to try to combat these exact problems. The challenge here is that this is not an easy fix. I'm heartened by the individual people that I know at Facebook and at Google who are working really hard on some of these problems. There's like systems level issues though. So it can't just be individual people or teams of people. Companies have to be willing to make changes. So I don't think the problem just has to do with the technology or the transmission of information. We have a civility problem. And I think we also have a problem. I mean, some of this is targeted national security issues and targeted information or society hacking by other nations. Some of this is just people being really mean to each other. So one thing we could do as we go into this new year is, you know, make a decision that we don't want to do that anymore. It doesn't serve our interests over the longer term.
Social media platforms tend to amplify this type of incivility and disinformation. So we'll just have to all be very vigilant, make sure we don't fall for false information and be able to distinguish between that which is true and that which is false. But I'm afraid that is just about all the time we have on this edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank our special guests on this annual Futures edition of the program, kicking off 2021, Amy Webb. She's author, futurist, and founder of Future Today Institute. and Mark Palatucci, who is a futurist with the company. Press Conference USA was produced in Washington, and joining me on the program was my colleague and our in-house science guru, Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Please join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.